Thank you. Be seated. The court is ready to hear arguments in A&T Consultants, Inc. v. Sharp from Relator.
May it please the court, Mr. Troy Belker will present argument for Relator. Relator is reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court, as you can perhaps tell from our briefs in this case, the first issue and obviously the most important issue is that of jurisdiction and whether or not we have started this case in the right place, that is, here before this court. And the Attorney General suggests that we should have brought this in district court because the Open Records Act assumes that this kind of action will be brought in district court in Travis County. Our response is that Section 22.002 of the Government Code very clearly says only this court has jurisdiction to grant a writ of mandamus against an officer of the Executive Department, and that's exactly what the Comptroller's Office is. The Attorney General also cites to cases that say factual determinations should not be made by an appellate court, they should be made by a trial court, and I think that is certainly true. I agree with their reading of those cases, but our position is that the facts in this case are really very clear, and in every sort of mandamus action there are going to be some facts, obviously.
What if they weren't clear at all?
What if they weren't clear at all?
Yes.
Then I think we have a problem in that we have to somehow rationalize Section 22.002 with the decisions by this court and other courts saying that resolution of factual issues should be by a trial court. And perhaps that is the dividing line that needs to be drawn.
What factual disputes do we have here?
Your Honor, I don't believe we have any factual disputes. And our position is that we asked for certain information, and in the first case, there was an open records decision issued that said the information requested should be open to the public. In the second case, there was a written request for information. The Comptroller did not ask for a decision of the Attorney General, excuse me, and under the Open Records Act, if the Comptroller fails to ask for an Attorney General decision, it is presumably public information. So what we're dealing with is information that, in our opinion, is already presumed to be public. And under the case of Hancock, the person seeking to prevent disclosing information that is presumed to be public has to show a compelling reason why that information is not public. It's not enough just to say, well, we can fit that into some exception in the statute. They have to show a compelling reason. And I believe that the facts, and I use that term in quotation marks, that the Attorney General has tried to bring forward in its briefs are really excuses to cover up the fact that it simply does, simply does not want to disclose information that it's required under the law to disclose.
Ms. Volker, do you agree that there is some information the Comptroller's Office is not required to disclose?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And you're taking the position that the specific items that you have sought disclosure of are not any of those items that you're not entitled to have?
That is correct.
The Comptroller argues, however, by combining information, by taking one set of information that is subject to disclosure, and then by taking some other information that on its face is subject to disclosure, you can tie together certain identifying characteristics to calculate the information that is not subject to disclosure. Do you accept, do you understand that's their argument, and do you accept that some of the items that you requested by doing your own checking out numbers, you could discover information that the information directly itself would not be discoverable? Do you agree that that's correct or not.
I understand that that's your argument, and I absolutely disagree. And I would also suggest that the examples that the Comptroller has brought forward to this court in its briefs are just not true. And in our
would that be a fact-finding, though, to determine whether that linkage, that calculation, those tracing numbers would produce the result that the Comptroller is saying would occur?
I certainly believe that that is a legitimate argument to be made, but my feeling is that that's simply a conclusion. They want to say this is a possible example, and the conclusion that we reach from this possible example is that we're giving away confidential information. Our position is that that is an example, but the conclusion that you're drawing from that supposed example is not correct, and that is not a fact-finding kind of inquiry. It's simply a, what conclusions, what legitimate conclusions can you draw from what they say are the facts. Before I go on, I think it's also important for us to emphasize to this court the chronology of events, and we're dealing with two different kinds of information that's been requested. The first kind is information related to refunds, and Mr. Harrison and the relator here asked for the names of, back in June of 1990, asked for names of persons who had received a refund from the state and the amount of those refunds. And it took 4 years for the Attorney General to finally release an open records decision addressing those issues. And then after that was in June of 1994 that the Attorney General released that open records decision, which is number 624. Then when the Comptroller gets that open records decision, at least from the outside world, it does nothing. Mr. Harrison writes several letters dated July 21st. One of them is saying, where's my information? And it's only after they get that letter do the Comptroller go back to the Attorney General and say, we want you to reconsider this issue about the amount of refunds. And we believe that that is very, very important in that under the statute, the Open Records Act, that is not a method that they can choose to follow. They have two choices. They can either comply with the open records decision or they can file suit in district court in Travis County. Now, the Open Records Act does not specifically say that, but if you look at the criminal enforcement provisions of that, Section 552.353 says that it is an affirmative defense to a criminal prosecution if the officer can show that within 10 days after receiving the open records decision, it files suit in Travis County District Court seeking relief from having to disclose information that the Attorney General said was open records. And I would also point out that the El Paso Court of Appeals, at least in passing, acknowledged that that exactly was the intent of the Act, that the Act says any agency seeking to avoid disclosure must file suit in district court in Travis County. What we have here is the Comptroller saying, I don't want to give that information out, let's try a second bite at the apple with the Attorney General's office. So it's our position that all of this information regarding the refunds and the refund names, the refund amounts, is presumed to be open records right now, and the burden is on the Comptroller to show a compelling reason as to why that should not be turned over as we have requested.
Mr. Volker, you say that, I guess, that the your position that once the opinion is issued and the 10 days expires, that they're presumed open and there's really no moment to the fact the AG withdrew their opinion 624. Or is that some consideration that after the fact the AG withdrew that opinion and we're kind of sitting here?
I will point out to the court that the Attorney General withdrew its opinion its open records decision after we had filed this action here. And the, I believe that is one of the exhibits to the Attorney General's brief. The letter says, given the fact that an action has been filed seeking mandamus, we believe that the court is the appropriate forum, and we're closing our file on this entire matter. So,
is it critical to your presentation to us that we somehow give effect to the, to give effect to that opinion? You have said that it's presumed to be public information because of it. Is it critical to your case that we meet the threshold question of whether or not that opinion still, I mean, whether the AG can in fact withdraw an opinion either during the course of litigation or prior to or after or something? Do we have to reach that?
No. I would agree that it's critical to the initial determination of is this information presumed to be public. If it could somehow be decided that the Attorney General withdrew its opinion because it was incorrect or whatever, and now it's changed its mind, then yeah, that might do something to our to that threshold question, as you put it. But that's not the end of our argument, because we're also saying this information that we're requesting is absolutely open records, that there is nothing in it that we can use to determine anything about the confidential business affairs of any taxpayer. And that was one of your prior questions, and which I would like to address in a little bit more detail. What we're asking for first are people who have gotten refunds and refund amounts. The fact that Troy Velker got a refund of $100,000 says nothing about my law practice, because nobody knows why I got that refund. We're not asking for the reason for refund. We're just asking for who got them and in what amounts. And again, in my example, if I got a refund of $100,000, I could have accidentally wrote a check for $100,000 too much. I could have made a calculation error. I could be seeking a franchise tax refund for any number of reasons.
Is that the only information you're asking?
That's the first category of information with respect to the refunds. We're asking for the names of those who got refunds and the amount of the refund. Then the second area that we're asking about, and the area that was requested in a letter dated July 21st, 1994, are these audit codes. And the controller's position apparently is we're going to take these audit codes and we're going to find out something about how these taxpayers are doing business. And the list of the codes that are in question are in both parties' briefs, but I think it's important that the controller's brief here, in our estimation, is simply an effort to cover up what it's really doing. And what it's really doing is seeking to keep information from someone who is legitimately and legally asking for it. It's saying that every single one of these codes is somehow going to tell Mr. Harrison, I believe their words are, it would convey information about the underlying financial circumstances or would support strong inferences about those circumstances. To me, that's absolutely meaningless. That's not a compelling reason for not giving out information. And two of the codes, the tax code, and the audit method code, the tax code being franchise tax or sales tax or whatever, and the audit method being sampling or a detailed study, that doesn't say anything about the taxpayer's business. That just tells us what the controller was doing. And they don't even offer an explanation for why that is confidential. Yet, they are still saying this is confidential and we shouldn't have to disclose it. And another example is the assignment code and audit group and audit reasons are all codes that the controller assigns and is part of its database. And the controller's explanation now is, no, if we told a person that information, then that would let people know who we're investigating for fraud. And as we stated in our brief, we have absolutely no desire to compromise any fraud investigation. There are people out there committing fraud. We want the controller to go after them. And the easy answer And an answer never suggested by the controller is just delete those taxpayers. There are hundreds of thousands of taxpayers in the controller's database, and only a handful of them are being investigated for fraud. And our, and with all of these codes, there is absolutely nothing that is going to be revealed about the confidential business affairs of any taxpayer.
Any other questions? Thank you, Commissioner. Great to hear argument from respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Chris Johnson, present argument for respondent.
May it please the court. This original proceeding is an indemnity action that was brought against the Comptroller of Public Accounts, John Sharp, is brought pursuant to the Texas Open Records Act. Entitled to release of information that was submitted to the Comptroller from franchise taxpayers of the state of Texas. So the information, great proportion of the information that is sought by the relator is in fact not information per se that belongs to the state, but it is in fact information that taxpayers were obligated to submit to the state. The case exemplifies the tension and policies underlying the Texas Open Records Act, the privacy rights of the taxpayers as enunciated in the Texas Tax Code, as well as some of the requirements of the Comptroller's Office in engaging in tax enforcement and collection efforts.
Which of the records sought involve disclosure of records that have been submitted by a taxpayer?
Well, Your Honor, in the subsequent request in 1994, the relator is seeking information. I think, for example, the relator is seeking an agreement code, which is, in fact, information supplied by the taxpayer as to whether or not they agree with the results of the
audit. Does it have some stipulated facts?
Well, it's a statement by the taxpayer as to whether or not they're in concurrence with the results of the audit. So it is information directly from the taxpayer.
But does it have any details as to what was alleged or what they're agreeing to? Does it just...
I believe the codes indicate about two or three possible types of agreement, but I don't think it is precise in that it says whether or not they agree that a certain percentage or a certain dollar amount they're in agreement with.
I don't understand then what taxpayer records you are being required to disclose.
Well, there are one or two instances like that that I just enunciated where it's information that's directly from the taxpayer. There is other information that is more secured or obtained or derived from the taxpayer or the taxpayer's record, which the Comptroller's Office believes is privileged under either Section 111.06 of the Tax Code or Section 171.206 or 208 of the Tax Code, which concerns franchise taxpayers.
Well, are you suggesting that all of the information is confidential and you're not required to disclose any of the information at all?
It is the position of the Comptroller's Office that basically almost all of the information submitted to the Comptroller's Office pursuant to the franchise tax or the sales tax or the amusement tax, which have specific confidentiality provisions, unlike the other tax codes, but those taxes, information that is submitted to the Comptroller's Office, that is in fact confidential, and other than a simple list of the taxpayers and names and addresses, that information is confidential.
And who has obtained refunds, that list, is that confidential?
Yes, Your Honor. The relator does not really address positions in our brief. For example, the refund amount, which on its face would seem to be fairly innocuous and a bit of information that doesn't attribute any information about the underlying company, there are several instances, for example, the Atlantic Monthly series of cases where a certain taxing method has been overruled by a court decision. And as a consequence, there's a series of refunds which are directly related to the volume of sales of the company. Anyone who sought that refund amount, it would be a fairly simple calculation to calculate the sales of each company. trying to say, that were that submitted taxes that were affected by that decision. So the refund amount would, in many cases over the last 4 or 5 years, the refund amount would tell you something specifically about the sales of the company.
Mr. Johnson, will you, my impression, will you run me through step by step how you do that? What is it about the information you provide that would indicate that this company got a refund because of that decision, and here was the amount of the refund, and this is how you calculate their business based on that refund? I mean,
I'm not sure I can, Your Honor. The there are certain provisions. I'm not a tax lawyer, Your Honor.
Well, I'll start this way. What did one of your arguments is that, well, they made one request, and this information we could give them. But we know they're going to make a second request, and the information we give them then will give them the connecting link between this first set of information and that information that then produces this non-disclosable information. And I'm having a hard time around how come one request can be proper and a second request be proper, but you don't have to honor them because if you put the two requests together, it'd be improper.
Your Honor, for example, the Comptroller's Office is working under the obligations of the confidentiality provisions of the tax code. And the Comptroller's Office does not want to violate the tax code. For example, if the relator requested or anyone requested a list of all companies that were audited in a particular year, and then if, for example, the relator wants the Comptroller's Office to under certain provisions, under certain information that they're requesting, would like the Comptroller's Office to remove all companies under which there is an active fraud investigation. Presumably, if you requested both of those over the course of time of a month or two or three, you would be able to, by subtracting one list from the other, you'd get a fairly reasonable estimation of which companies and the number of companies that were undergoing active fraud investigations in the Comptroller's Office. The Comptroller's Office, for example, receives, in the last 4 months, the Comptroller's Office has received over 9,000 requests for information on the Texas Open Records Act. And the Comptroller's Office is very wary of requests over time that can be assembled and will result in the Comptroller's Office violating the confidentiality provisions of the tax code.
How do we deal with an Open Records Act that says the first request is open? And the only argument the controller has is, well, if we honor this series of requests, then we are providing information that simply thought said we shouldn't provide. How do we deal with that kind of problem?
Well, the position of the Comptroller's Office that the Section 111.06 and Section 171.206 and 208 prohibit the release of all that information, so that neither this Court nor the Comptroller's Office has to concern itself with those sorts of second-guessing decisions, that they don't have to deal with that. If I may address the jurisdictional issues that were raised by the relator, it is the position of the Comptroller's Office that this court does not have jurisdiction to hear this because there are in fact factual disputes that need to be resolved. We've already spoken about some of them. The Texas Open Records Act seems to indicate that the legislature intended for these actions to be brought in district court, Charles County District Court. The Open Records Act is subsequent to the enactment of Government Code 22.002. It also is a more specific statute, which generally controls over more general statutes. And I think the relator has already spoken to the problem that if this court does have exclusive jurisdiction to hear these issues, and there are inherent factual disputes to be resolved, then the relator would have no forum in which to bring this.
So your position is that the relief sought here can be granted by the district court?
Yes, sir.
in the form of mandamus or something like that?
Mandamus declaratory relief, yes, sir. Contrary to the assertions of the relator, it is the legislature, not the comptroller, that has decided to make the records that are sought confidential. The information that was withheld in the original refund request was withheld by the comptroller's office pursuant to Section 111.06, which provides for the confidentiality of information that is secured, derived, or obtained by the comptroller or the attorney general during the course of examination of the taxpayer's records, which is far broader than the test the relator would have this court use or the test that was used in ORD 624. The problems with employing the underlying policy, which is the test that the relator has used, and that is whether whether the information sought can produce any information about the underlying company. The problem with employing that test is that it really doesn't provide an agency with any sort of practical guidance as to whether or not the information sought does in fact do that and violate in violation of either the confidentiality provisions of the tax code or those provisions of the Open Records Act. It's difficult to manage or to assess. You're constantly second-guessing yourself. There's no way to avoid the accumulation effect that we were speaking about in terms of adding together bits of information as a jigsaw puzzle. There's no way to respond to the Texas Monthly effect that I've alluded to. Texas Monthly, I believe it is. It's cited in the brief. The basis for withholding your audit information is, again, that it relates to internal audit procedures of the respondent. It is information that the relator is seeking about the beginnings of the audit discussions within the comptroller's office about whether or not there is information, whether or not an informant within the company has supplied the comptroller's office with information that's suggesting that an audit needs to be undertaken, whether or not agents in the field have noticed unreported sales. There's a lot of information that the comptroller's office believes is confidential pursuant to that provision. It is the position of the comptroller's office, as indicated in the brief, that it wasn't the intent of the legislature to open up the internal investigative and audit mechanisms of the comptroller's office to the public. We cite a couple of cases, I believe a case from this court, in regard to the Federal Freedom of Information Act and sort of mirror image protections that are given the Internal Revenue Service and its audit investigative apparatus. We cite the law enforcement and prosecutorial exemptions, and we also cite the provision of the Open Records Act, which prohibits or exempts the disclosure of internal agency memoranda, discovery advice, recommendations, and opinions that are not formal, which would be a lot of the information that were sought, which is the assignment codes, things that indicate that, well, maybe a certain taxpayer we may want to look into whether we're going to investigate them. We may want to look into whether we're going to audit them for fraud, but no final decision has been made. If a final decision has been made, that has been made public. And the relator is correct that I failed to address two issues in the brief. That was an oversight on our part. Number 9, which is the tax code, we in fact do make public, and that was a mistake. Number 19, the audit method, we think is confidential and is not to be released. It is contrary to what you may think. The comptroller's office releases information about the procedures that it uses, its policy manuals, how it undertakes an audit, what it looks at. The general procedures are released. Those are public. What is not released is the particular procedures that are chosen to apply to the problem that a particular taxpayer presents the comptroller's office, whether the data are in disarray, whether there is a huge volume of sales, which relies sampling methods, whether the volume of sale is much less, and that can be gone through on a case-by-case basis. Whether the data are in such poor shape because of whatever reasons in the company that there are quality problems. Those are different kinds of assignment decisions that are in response to the reality of the fiscal and underlying situation of the company. And this is the kind of information that the Comptroller's Office believes was made confidential by the tax code. The relator has addressed the issue of the one-month or several-week delay after receipt of ORD 624. I believe I probably should address that. The respondent is unaware of any statutory timetable to respond once there has been a decision by the Attorney General's Opinions Committee, Open Records Opinions Committee. The 10-day rule that exists elsewhere in there that creates a presumption that the information is public, we think the case law quite clearly exempts information in which the information that is being sought and that is presumed public is third-party information, which is the case here, and which is, in fact, made confidential by statute.
How much of the information sought here is discoverable by the party being audited? Does that...
A great deal of the information that is sought, I believe, is discoverable by the party that's being audited. But
here they're asking for third-party information.
That is correct, Your Honor. When the...
So you're saying that the comptroller's right to seek a reconsideration by the Attorney General is there's no statutory limitation or no implied provision of reasonableness or reasonable time to either seek a declaratory judgment in district court or some clarification? It can just keep asking for reconsideration?
Well, as I read the statute is silent about how the custodian of this information would challenge an open records decision. It appears to direct someone like the relator to challenge it, and it appears that there is a case, Hubert v. Hartke Hanks, in which because the custodian did not challenge an open records decision in a timely manner in 10 days, that did not preempt them from challenging the reasoning behind the opinion in a subsequent mandamus or declaratory action.
Did not preempt the interested party?
The custodian, right, and presumably the real party in interest. The
so they could either challenge it, they could either seek an AG's opinion, or they can reiterate the same arguments in a later lawsuit?
Correct, Your Honor. What the Comptroller's Office did in this case was seek reconsideration. The opinion was very long, and it dealt with many different requests, not just the relators.
Isn't that a little inconsistent with the criminal penalties provisions that relator cited us to earlier, that if you don't turn over the documents within a specified time or seek an AG's opinion, that there are criminal penalties attached?
Yes, it is, Your Honor. But Hubert v. Hartke Hanks precisely addresses that issue and says that it's inapplicable in a civil action, as I read the case.
I'm sorry, what's inapplicable?
That the 10-day presumption is only relevant in a criminal prosecution. The opinion addressed several requests for open records, and it also made reference in the document itself to notes that were made on specific pieces of information that were representative of what was requested. It took a couple of weeks for that information to get back to those documents, for those to get back to the Comptroller's Office, and then it took them days to, there were two full boxes just filled with paper, and they had to go through and look for the notes to relate to the comments in the opinion. And once after that, then the Comptroller's Office had to assess what its response to the opinion was, plus it takes a matter of, because of the complexity of setting up the computers, to do this, it would take a week to 2 weeks to respond to a particular request for the kind of magnitude of information that the relator sought, and there were many, not just the relators that were addressed in that opinion. So it's the respondent's position that the several weeks between receipt, the publication of RD 614 and its request for reconsideration was not dilatory. In conclusion, the respondent would like this court to deny petitioner's petition for mandamus. We believe that there are several factual disputes that need to be resolved in the district court, and we believe that the Texas legislature has made information sought confidential and hence cannot be released. Thank you.
Any questions? Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court, once again, let me emphasize again that we are not asking for anything like the amount of sales or officers' salaries or the amount of tax that's been paid by a particular company. We're asking initially for the persons who received the refund and the amount of those refunds.
So do you agree that if between all of the requests the comptroller receives, the puzzle could be pieced together until the shape of the missing piece were indisputable, i.e. the amount of sales of the company. That they should not have to disclose the information that would lead to that calculation.
If there was a way for someone to very cleverly ask and piece together, then yes, I would say that should be not disclosed.
So there might be one of the pieces which would otherwise be disclosable, but given those circumstances, would have to be withheld.
Certainly. I mean, I don't want people knowing how much I report on my franchise tax return. But that's not the situation here, because we're asking for all persons who have received refunds. And the Texas Monthly example that's cited by the comptroller is a situation where the court said that certain periodical publications were not subject to sales tax, and so the comptroller had to go back and issue refunds. They're suggesting that we somehow know that a particular taxpayer got a Texas Monthly refund. There's no way in the world that we'd know that. We're asking for all taxpayers who got a refund and the amount of those refunds. If it turns out, and my law firm got a refund because the Texas Monthly case applied to publications like Matthew Bender and those kinds of things. If my name appears on a refund list that I got $200 or whatever it was in refund, that doesn't tell anybody anything about me.
But isn't there some sort of coding that indicates the company and a coding that indicates the audit that was used, and by checking out the codes you could determine that this company got a Texas Monthly refund because here's the company, here's the refund, and over here, here's an audit code that says Texas Monthly. And that audit code has a coding that indicates it belongs to that client.
There may well be those kinds of codes, and I'd be surprised if there weren't. But see, we're not asking for that. We're not simply asking for everybody who got a refund, how much did they get? And we don't have any idea of why that refund was given.
Aren't you asking for the audit codes?
Now, the audit codes are a completely separate issue, and the audit codes are not going to tell you whether or not the audit codes that we're asking for are not going to tell you whether a person got a refund for a particular reason, at least not the codes that we're asking for. The codes that we're asking for are the type of taxes being audited, what audit group did the audit, those kinds of things.
Public information. What taxes are paid by what entity, or what, not considering an audit, I should say. is that information subject to public review?
You mean, could you find out that my law firm pays franchise tax and sales tax?
And the amount?
Not the amounts, no. And we're not asking for the amounts paid. The amounts are confidential, and we...
They are?
Yes, and we absolutely agree with that.
Counsel, because the Constitution grants us the original exclusive jurisdiction to issue a writ against an officer of the Executive Department, would it be your argument that we would have to consider by writ of mandamus any open records disputes that may relate between a requester and the treasurer and the attorney general, as well as the comptroller, and that we are going to be, in effect, the court of first and last resort in these kind of disputes with those state officers?
That is what I'm suggesting, that in this kind of case, that's the way I read 22.004.
Thank you, counsel. That concludes the argument and the causes on today's oral submission docket. All of these causes are submitted on briefs and oral arguments, and the marshal will adjourn the court.
Oye, 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 oye. Honorable Supreme Court of Texas.